Which one is this? This is Mitch and Amy?
This is Mitch and Amy.
Mitch and Amy. Okay, let me get this up on my Kindle here.
Yeah, here we are. Mitchell's skateboard. Oh boy, we're ready to go.
Okay.
If you didn't, if you were under the assumption that this book couldn't get any worse, there are the beautiful Tracy Dockray.
Yeah, those I've been dealing with all the last couple weeks here,
which seem even less thought out than her usual. Like, she just did not give two thoughts about these illustrations. They don't, half the characters don't even look human.
But to be fair, this book just doesn't really inspire anything. I mean,
you know, it's funny because I was like, I really dislike this book, like, a lot. Like, more so than I've disliked a lot of things I've read recently. But it actually has given me a lot of things to chew on, because it fails on a level that goes above and beyond even her, like, Leave It to Beaver books. Because at least those were, like, just jobs she didn't care about. Whereas it feels like a lot of thought went into Mitch and Amy.
Yeah.
It just wasn't followed through on.
Well, I have my theory, and I'll bring that up in the as we get into this.
Good, good. So my question for you is,
yep,
how do we want to start this?
Well, we could always start with the opening lines.
Mitchell Huff's day began like any other summer day, with a squabble with his twin sister Amy. At breakfast, Amy grabbed a cereal box top and said, "I'm going to send away for the plastic harmonica that looks like an ear of corn." "Oh no, you don't," said Mitchell. "It's my turn to get the box top." "It is not," said Amy. "You got the last one." "But it wasn't a good box top," said Mitchell. "How come you get all the good box tops?" I think that pretty much sums up the book right there. Endless bickering between two siblings about inconsequential stuff.
If I may, I'd like to open with an anecdote here.
Go ahead.
One of my patented anecdotes that doesn't seem like it's making any sense, but it does kind of circle around, which is,
yes,
when I was in high school, I went to school with a pair of twins who, okay, were fraternal twins. They were both girls in spite of being called fraternal twins. One of them was in band with me. And I will always remember that this one year for April Fool's, they thought it would be a hilarious prank to play that they would switch classes that day, that the one girl took, the other girl would go into. And I will always remember the girl who was not in marching band sitting in the front row with the bassoon in her hand, not knowing what to do. And our conductor came in, glanced down at her, and said, "Huh, what are you doing here?" They thought this was going to be absolutely a hilarious pratfall. and it just fell absolutely flat. Neither of them was close enough looking to the other that there was any surprise in what was going on. And I bring this up by way of saying, twins hold a certain fascination in popular culture, but they don't really sustain as a concept. You can't just have a book with the concept of twins,
right?
And this book to me feels very strange, because I know that Clary herself is a mother of twins,
yes,
of fraternal male and female twins, and I suspect that this book was written in some ways as a personal attempt to reflect upon the life that those two were leading at that point.
Oh, clearly, yeah.
But like a lot of things based on personal experience, or at least on the author's family, she treats it all with such kid gloves. It's like she's not going to make these characters into anything. She's not going to give them any weaknesses or foibles or bad characteristics because they're her kids.
Well, see, and I see it completely opposite from that. I see it as, because they're her kids and she's writing, I'm going to assume most of this is based on actual things that happened with her kids. All I see are a parent complaining about her kids. Because all Mitch and Amy do for literally a percentage of this book is just pick at each other, just goad each other, but not like in a charming way, and not in a way where they ever learn from like any lessons. As I was summarizing this book, every other sentence was Mitch and Amy fight again, Mitch and Amy fight again, Mitch and Amy fight again. Like, I got so sick of writing it. I was like, oh, they keep fighting. Up, here they go fighting again, because each alternating chapter is kind of from the perspective of the other character. Each one just sort of seems to think they're in the right, and that's it. By the end of the book, they've just goaded each other a lot, and they've learned nothing.
I agree with that, but I also think that I get the feeling that I've gotten before with some of Clary's writing, which is she's too attached to the actual event.
Yeah.
To let it develop organically into an interesting narrative. It's sort of like there's a point in this book where Mitch is being bullied by the psychopathic Alan by
yes.
having eucalyptus buds thrown at him, which is such a peculiar, specific thing to describe that you kind of get the feeling that, yeah, this must have been based on something that Clary witnessed, but it doesn't go anywhere. You know, it's like, what do you expect to happen? That a panda shows up out of nowhere?
Well, I've got a theory, and before I put it forward, I would like to inform our readers that we are discussing Mitch and Amy, Beverly Cleary's novel from 1967 that comes after The Mouse and the Motorcycle, as far as her novels goes. But it's a book about a twins, Mitch and Amy, who live outside San Francisco, and just kind of there, and just kind of, well, like you said, there's really not much of a plot for Mitch and Amy, at least. It's about the end of the summer and the beginning of fourth grade, like, more or less.
There is this ongoing plot with Mitch being bullied by the neighborhood bully Alan,
mm-hmm.
and there is this ongoing plot about the kids' rivalry around certain scholastic things. That
yes.
Amy is a good reader and Mitch is good at math. Neither of those come together in any way, though.
No, you get a lot of neat little. You do get a lot of really neat little Beverly Cleary details, like about the way like the girls play Pioneer Girls, like they're obsessed with Little House on the Prairie. You get this strange introduction at this point. So this book sort of sits on the edge of like sort of the generational like divide, or like it's at the end of the early 60s and the beginning of the late 60s as far as like what's happening in the culture. Because all of a sudden the schools are completely redone with what at the time was advanced technology. All the classrooms get television sets and record players and tape decks to help learn. Like, there's this pervading sense of like technology invading the classroom and replacing teachers as your child's primary source of education. You get the introduction of skateboarding as a pastime. Suddenly, like, the kids aren't interested in riding bikes. They're all the boys have their own skateboards, and Mitchell invents his own skateboard just to see if he can do it. Like, there's these weird, it's at this weird point culturally that I think Beverly Cleary was trying to tap into, like, what's happening with the kids these days? Like, oh my goodness, like, school is changing. The way kids interact is changing. Bullies are no longer just the older kid who picks on your kid. Bullies are suddenly, like, violent and something you have to, like, kind of deal with directly. Girls are suddenly able to fight and are a little more independent, and moms are going back to college, and there's a lot of like cultural stuff going on here that, well, like you said, doesn't actually come to anything.
You keep wanting there to be some point to this. There's a, as you mentioned, the idea of audiovisual equipment is brought up so much in this book, and it's kind of presented in kind of a ridiculous way, like that the teachers give what amounts to a drill in the times table, but they do it via a tape recorder rather than simply speaking the test aloud, because there's this idea of standardization that's coming through here.
Yes.
And you think that Cleary is on the verge of making some kind of pointed remark about the ridiculousness of the situation, but it never quite gets there.
Right. It really screws up Amy, and it becomes like there is this test sequence in the book where Amy is terrible at multiplication tables. There's a strong implication in this book that, well, girls are bad at math and boys are bad at reading, and that's just the way it is, that I found very distasteful. Like, it's Mitchell is a terrible reader. It sort of posits that, like, oh, Mitchell has a horrible time learning how to read. He just needs a book about cowboys. You give a boy a book about cowboys, and all of his learning problems will go out the window, because it's really just about giving a boy the book he wants to read. And Amy's just bad at math. And they get this timed, like you said, this timed test that's like 10 pages of the book. Like, it goes on. Like, and it's incredibly tense and, like, horribly unfair. Like, this poor girl is just, she can't keep up with the test because that's not the way it's not helping her at all. And yeah, it builds and it builds and it builds. And you think something's going to come out of it. And all that happens is the electricity, they blow a fuse at the school, they can't finish the test, and then you never hear about it again. Like, presumably all the electricity is off at the school for the rest of the year, and the kids never have to make up this test. And then the audiovisual aids are just forgotten about for the rest of the story. It's like Beverly Cleary wanted to make a point, but instead she just kind of made a joke and moved on.
It's funny that this is so flat, because this is the thing that Beverly Cleary does so well, is get inside the heads of little kids who, and deal very seriously with anxieties that you have at different ages of your life that you may have forgotten as an adult. And that's one of the things that's remarkable about her, is her imagination that allows her to do that. We're going to be getting to Ramona next in these books, and that is all through those books, are these moments of intense brilliant clarity into the head of a kindergartner. But man, this just, yeah, like you say, it just kind of ends on, oh, they blew a fuse. And again, that is almost a joke about, oh, technology, ha ha ha. But
no one seems to learn from it. Like, there's not a point where the school is like, wow, this audiovisual stuff isn't actually working out. It's actually to the detriment of our students' education. So they got rid of all the audiovisual equipment and they focused on the student. Like, no, it's just they move on to the next thing. I guess she's constantly tormenting Mitchell because he's having trouble reading, and he's constantly tormenting her because she can't do math. And in the end, she helps him learn to read, I guess. He gets sick and confined to bed, and she gets him a book on Wild Bill Hickok, and he's like, oh, I like Wild Bill Hickok. I guess I'll learn to read now. And then he agrees to drill her on her times tables, which you assume works. Like, you assume that's the end of it. Like, that there's no follow through on any of this, though. It's just, it's incident, and then they just move on.
Yeah.
But I have a theory, if you'll bear with me for a second.
Sure.
That, first of all, that her publisher was probably like, you've got twins. Please write us a book about twins while you're working on whatever this Ramona book is that you're working on. Because it feels like she kind of was saving up all of her good insight for her next book, which was, of course, the first major Ramona book. But to me, you know, thinking about this book and chewing it over and looking at it way too close, it feels more like this isn't a book about Mitch and Amy. This, to me, is a book about Alan Hibbler. Who is the bully that we were discussing. And he's not just a bully. He is a psychopath. Like, not in the, like, flip, all of our politicians are psychopaths way that people talk about, but he's a manipulative, violent, horrifically focused child who, through the course of the book, the first time we meet him, he interacts with Mitchell by grabbing Mitchell's homemade skateboard and just smashing it against a bus stop pole. Just smashing it. And then throwing it at Mitchell and demanding he run, like, or else you're going to get hurt. And every interaction with Alan is escalated. Alan's throwing the eucalyptus buds at him. And then when he challenges Mitchell to a game of chicken, he wins, but then he crashes his bike, which should have taught him a lesson in humility, but instead causes him to ramp up his torment. And it keeps ramping up. Like, he starts throwing dirt at Mitchell. And then he tries to break Amy's homemade piñata, but when he can't break it, when Amy gets to school, he just spits on her and walks off. And it just keeps, like, the spitting scene is the moment where I was like, oh, like, he's not just a bully who's, like, just trying to make up for something he's missing in his life. Like, he's vindictive, and he lacks sympathy, and he doesn't see these kids around him as, like, human beings. And it just keeps escalating until he is humiliated by a girl who is Bernadette, who is the only, to me, interesting character in this book. And then we get this weird ending where, like, he misspells a word while he's tormenting the kids. And Mitch and Amy are like, oh, he can't spell. I guess he's not so bad after all. And then that's it. The book just literally just ends right there. And I was like, oh, this is a book about a bully learning that he can humiliate and torment and manipulate people through violence and intimidation. And then in the end, also through emotional manipulation. Like, the person who comes out on top at the end of this book is Alan. He's the winner. He wins. He gets everything he wants. He never gets in trouble. And he's the ultimate, like, he's the ultimate manipulative bully. And I was like, that's terrifying. Like, this boy's going to go through the rest of his life knowing that he can get away with whatever he wants.
Yeah, I think Alan is written more sinister and more violent than you would ever expect a Beverly Cleary character to be written. And
yes.
Kind of blankly, like this kind of, he presents the world with this blank face of rage that mm-hmm. simply wants to torment. There's an attempt made to explain a bit of his personality by saying that his father is super famous and he may be tired of living in his father's shadow. But even that is just so inadequate in any way. And it's also quite funny that to think that this entire school full of grade school kids knows who his father is because he's a famous scientist at the university.
Yes. Well, the fact that his father is famous, the Judson Hibbler, by the way, just to me compounds the fact, like, so the mother says, but he looks like such a nice boy. He's clean cut and has good manners. And then Amy says, he's the type who's nice to grown-ups, but not to children. He doesn't have evil beady eyes or anything like that, but he's a bully just the same. And the kids freak out when the mom is like, oh, I'm going to talk to his parents. They're like, no, 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 no. And I'm like, this is supposed to be, it's supposed to sort of support the fact that, like, ah, he's just like this crappy kid and his father's famous and he feels inadequate because of his father. But I'm like, I think his father may be the same way. And I think he's just dead inside. Like, I think this is a kid who just has no morals, has never been taught morals, and can't be taught morals. I don't know. Like you said, there's something wholly sinister about Alan. He has no come to Jesus moment. He has no, like, he doesn't learn anything. He's not like, oh, who's the boy from Scooter McCarthy?
Right.
He's not like Scooter from the old Henry Huggins books, who's like a jerk, but then you realize, oh, he's just being a jerk because he's trying to jockey for his position in this neighborhood. No, he's just this dark child. He's We Need to Talk About Kevin. Like if you've ever read that book, like, you're like, he's just tormenting for the sake of tormenting, and this is gonna come to no good. I can't get over the fact that Beverly Cleary wrote an evil character.
You mentioned the first time we see him, he goes from just kind of making snarky comments and smoking a cigarette to suddenly grabbing Mitchell's skateboard and smashing it. And that is so shocking. The 0 to 60 of that in the book is so shocking that as I was starting this, I was kind of wondering, huh, is Cleary going to try something completely different in this book? You know, is this going to be Cleary's, Robert Cormier book or something like that? But,
yep.
But no, it isn't. I mean, the problems that Mitch and Amy continue to have are simply, oh, I'm bad at math, I'm bad at reading. We squabble because we're two middle-class white kids living in the suburbs of San Francisco.
So what's weird about this book is, as you heard from the opening paragraph, for opening few lines, the writing isn't very good. Like, just the opening chapter, it almost reads like she's writing at a much lower reading level. Just the way Mitch and Amy interact, it's very like storybook. And like, oh, Amy finds a dandelion and she tries to blow the dandelion, and somehow between picking up the dandelion, inhaling and getting ready to blow the seeds off, Mitchell, well, here it is. She closed her eyes to make a wish. Mitchell looked at his sister standing there in her play clothes with her knees bruised, her brown hair falling to her shoulders, and her summer freckles bright in the September sunshine. Her lips were puckered beside the dandelion's white head as if they had been drawn up by a string. He saw her chest rise as she drew a deep breath and held it for a moment. Suddenly the temptation was too great for Mitchell. Gathering his breath, he rose and moved swiftly and silently across the concrete on his rubber soles. Whoof! Mitchell blew as hard as he could. Somehow in between her inhaling and exhaling, Mitchell is able to identify what she's done, observe her in her full, like, physical, like, stance, realize she's going to blow the seeds off a dandelion, feel the temptation, cross an entire concrete patio, and blow the dandelion seeds off before she... Like, the writing is terrible. Like, it doesn't make any sense. Like, you get this, like, weird... It doesn't make any... Like, I was like, oh, what's happening? Like, what is happening? Like, is this a dream? Like, I don't understand... Like, what are these children? Who are these children? Like, what is even happening? Like, you get this weird, like, almost fetishization of his sister for two paragraphs, and then nothing happens. He just blows the, like, that's impossible. There's impossible things. And then, but then the chapter ends with, like, him getting, like, almost killed by a bully. Like, I don't, like, and then kids smoking? Like, we've never seen kids smoke in a Beverly Cleary novel before. And all of a sudden, it's just sort of, like, tossed off, like, yep, kids are smoking now in junior high, I guess. Like, I don't, there's so much going on, like this almost elementary school level of children interacting, but then also like a bully, like I was so confused, and that was just chapter one, and there's like 100 chapters in this book. It's like 500 pages long.
We talked about how scenes never thematically built anything. They also just stop dead from a description. It's like Cleary just gets tired of what she's writing about and just ends. And there's no logic to why one sequence is in one chapter or another. It's just a chapter is a string of incidents that probably aren't related to one another, to the point that when we get to the very end of this book, I really did a double take trying to figure out where the extra pages were at the end of my copy, because it just ends. It just completely, like, there's not even a moment where there's some pat little description of how what Mitch and Amy have learned about this whole experience or what. It just, like, oh, off to school now.
Yeah, and because it ends, the last paragraph is after Alan's been humiliated and they realize that he can't be so bad because he can't spell, just like Mitchell, which is literally the way, like, they resolve it. It's like, oh, he's a bad speller too. He must be embarrassed that he can't spell, which is why he's threatening to kill a child. And then so there's this character, Bernadette, who I mentioned her before. I love her. She's this girl who just don't care. She doesn't She has a ton of brothers and sisters. She's fiercely independent. She has a crush on Mitchell, I guess. Like, that never goes anywhere, really. Amy, none of the girls like her because she's slovenly and she just don't care. But Amy makes friends with her because she's a good... It's just, it goes on. They spend the entire the last chapter is, again, like, incredibly long. It's half of it is Amy and Bernadette making cupcakes, and then they take them to school, and then Alan steals a cupcake because Amy left the cupcakes on the ground. Like, I don't – none of it makes any sense. But he threatens to eat the cupcakes. Bernadette attacks him. She's humiliating him by being stronger than he is or something. And then they're like, no, Bernadette, don't beat him up. He can't spell. And then the last paragraph, though, is Mitchell bounds across the asphalt as if he has springs in his steps and not a care in the world. Amy watched him. And as he took the steps to his temporary classroom in one leap, she thought, I'm glad there are two of us, one me and one Mitchell. And that's the end of the book. Like, one paragraph before, they were discussing how Alan wouldn't dare bully him or anyone else because a girl got him down on the ground. And then it just, like you said, it just ends. Like, there's no resolution. It just ends.
The way Bernadette takes Alan down is she does a leg sweep, which suggests that she's had some sort of martial arts training. It's, you know, it seems like either a judo or a jiu-jitsu move, and she's able to pin him down with this. And there's an interesting repudiation of some of the gender essentialism that has been going on in this story, because Bernadette, as you say, is just a slob. She doesn't care about popular sentiment or what, you know, she's not interested in playing social games, and she's the one who's able to take Alan down through a certain amount of expertise in fighting. Yes. And so there's an interesting case that could be made here as Bernadette popping in to say, forget you and your mid-60s boy-girl ideas. But that's not developed. But I think that's part of the reason why we react strongly to her, because she's just a bundle of energy and she gets things done.
I wanted a book about Bernadette's family because they are the only interesting characters in this book. Her mom is going to school, which is unusual to Amy. Like, Amy points out that, like, a lot of the moms talk about taking a few classes after the kids get older, but no one ever really follows through with it. And then there's Bernadette's mom, who's like, yeah, my kids are older, I can go back to college and, like get a degree. And she has older brothers, and so she knows how to handle boys, but she's also, like, good at cooking. She's I use in my notes, I was like, oh, this is Beverly Cleary's Mary Sue character. Like, she's ultimately good at everything. I bet she's also friends with Captain Kirk. Like, Bernadette is almost the too perfect of a character. Like, Beverly Cleary was so bored writing all the other characters that she had to write someone who was interesting, so she kind of overdid it. I was using Mary Sue, of course, in a facetious way. I don't believe in that trope. I think it's... Never mind. But also, like, Bernadette, like, torments Mitchell, and Amy's like, oh, she's doing that because she likes you, but then that doesn't come to anything. Like, there's so much happens in this book, but nothing happens in this book.
What this does remind me a little bit of is, I remember back in, I think it was Henry and the Clubhouse, where there was that sequence where Henry found himself suddenly taking care of this house full of children that were all out of control. The mom had to run out, and it seems that to me that Cleary has a certain affection for stories about people who just flaunt social convention, particularly when it comes to being gracious or being cleanly.
Yes.
Bernadette's family is just nuts. There's we're told that her brother keeps a punching bag made of an old sock full of, I forget what, hanging in a doorway. There's cats and a dog that are wandering all over the place. You know, I had a couple of friends like this growing up, where I did not grow up. If my mom's out there listening, she's probably going to be shocked to hear this, that I grew up with a certain amount of an expectation that I would keep my house neat. I didn't always succeed, but I loved visiting people's houses where they were just absolutely insanely messy. And so in the sequence where they go to Bernadette's house, I was imagining my pal from grade school.
Yeah. Yeah, I was not a neat child, but my parents kept the house spick and span. And when I would go to friends' houses that were like this, and of course I grew up in like the Texas suburbs, so every house was like kind of put together and you did things a certain way. But I would periodically go to a friend's house that was sort of ramshackle and seat of your pants, and I could not relate. Like I didn't know how to function in houses like that. Like I wasn't the kind of kid who was like, this is awesome. I was like, no. Like, this isn't how the world is supposed to work. And so I'm impressed with Amy for being able to, like, sort of go with the flow here. You mentioned the Henry Huggins book, but there was also one of the teen books. Which one was it? Where she goes to live in California with the family.
Oh, right.
And they're all just, like, super eccentric. Right. Like,
The Luckiest Girl.
Yeah, they do their laundry by moonlight and stuff.
Right.
Cleary has a fascination, I think, with families like that.
Cleary grew up in Yamhill in a very small farming community. And when you read her memoirs of being a child, she was kind of left to fend for herself. And she kind of loved that. And then when she moved into Portland, I think that she suddenly was exposed to the idea that there are mores and there are social do's and don'ts, and I think she's always kind of dealt with that,
yeah,
in some way or another.
Yeah, and I think it, because of the way it's presented in The Luckiest Girl and in this, it does seem, I don't know, almost to me to be a sign of, it's also a kind of a more of a California thing.
Yeah,
like this is something you're probably going to encounter when you step outside of your comfort zone. I don't know. I don't think that the Bernadette's family is particularly well presented. Like, I just don't think this book has any of the writing required to cover any of these characters. But it's definitely that one half of a chapter is definitely the most interesting part of this entire book, for me at least.
Now that you talk about it, I kind of wonder whether or not Bernadette's family are supposed to be hippies. You know, this is like this is written in what, 1967?
Yeah, like this is late 60s. I don't know, her mother is still like really well put together and everything. Yeah. She's studying chemistry.
Oh yeah.
She's still part of the system, man.
But you know, chemistry, that could be like she's studying LSD.
Right. To be name dropping a few like Timothy Leary and like, what's going on at that college of hers? No, I mean at the end of the so much of this book could have been like trimmed down. I don't know, like, it's just, it goes on and on. I listened to this book be read. I listened to this book first. I listened to it and then I went back and I started taking notes, and I didn't realize, because I listened to it at such a high rate, how long this book is. It just goes, like, so many of the chapters just go on and on. Like, if she's not going to spend 3 pages talking about soap suds all over the kitchen floor, she's going to spend 8 pages talking about soap suds on the kitchen floor. And Mitchell isn't going to come in and torment the girls once. He's going to come in and torment them 5 times. And they're going to ask their mother to make Mitchell leave them alone 3 times. Like, it's just, everything just happens repeatedly, and then each chapter just reiterates that Mitchell likes to torment Amy, and Amy likes to torment Mitchell, and they love each other, but they get on each other's nerves, and they like being twins, but sometimes it sure does stink being twins, and it never goes any deeper than that. It's just, like, yeah, that's, at the end of the book, you're like, yep, being siblings kind of stinks, but also it kind of doesn't stink. The end.
We've mentioned before other books by Beverly Cleary that have problems with the pacing, particularly like the first Henry Huggins book had problems with pacing. And the, I think Otis Spofford also was just crazily poorly paced. I think that this is a thing that happens with Clary from time to time, where she's a very good writer, but she lacks that completely ruthless editor ability to just see when something is not working and just cut it out entirely.
Yeah. Well, and I'm wondering, I mean, and of course there's no way of knowing this, but I'm wondering if this was a book that was just sort of tossed off because she was gearing up to start her magnum opus. Like, this was the last book before Ramona proper began, and I think maybe she was just saving up all of her inspiration and critical eye for those books, which, I mean, we'll be talking about Ramona the Pest next, and it's night and day from Mitch and Amy.
Yes. It's completely different. So, I hate to say it, I don't really have much more to say about Mitch and Amy. I feel like I was interested to have come across it. I see it more as a curiosity in some ways, but it's no wonder to me that this never got more than one book.
Yeah, I mean, it stayed in print, obviously. I think it was an experiment. I think she wanted to write about her kids. Like, you know, like, I have these twins. That's interesting. I know how to write about twins. And then it didn't really go anywhere. There wasn't anything else to say about the fact that, yep, twins exist and I got them and they're pretty much just like other kids. The end. So yeah, I think Alan was the more interesting part, but even that just kind of fell apart. Now, what's interesting is we did skip a book. We skipped her picture book, The Growing Up Feet, which came right before this. And it, too, is about twins. So maybe one day we can touch on that and see which is the better of the I Have Twins books, Mitch and Amy or The Growing Up Feet, because this isn't her only dip into what it's like to have kids who are twins. So we can take a look at them at some other point.
And before we say goodbye, I want to give a special recognition to one of our listeners out there named Jeff, who heard me talking about Rutgers and the Water Snouts last episode and pointed out to me that I could purchase a copy of the book for a very low price used, and I immediately went out and did so. It's a lovely copy that's in one of those library bindings, if you remember the library bindings that were big in the 60s and 70s.
Oh, yes.
And I'm not going to go too deeply into this, except that it is everything I could have hoped for and more. It is a very weird, strange, funny, crazy little book, and the author, Barbara Dana, is an amazing person that I did not know. Was married to Alan Arkin, wrote for Hollywood, appeared on the first couple of seasons of Sesame Street back in the early 70s, and is still writing today. If you look up Barbara Dana, you can find what she's up to now. One of these days, I will indulge in a long discussion of Rutgers and the Water Snouts, but I do recommend everybody who can get their hands on this book, find it and read it.
There we go. Not a recommendation for Mitch and Amy,
no.
But a strong recommend for Rutgers and the Water Snouts. A book that you keep trying to interest me in, apparently.
You've got to read this book. You have got to read this book.
So our next book will be Ramona the Pest.
Ramona the Pest. And, you know, for everyone who's, every one of you who stuck out this kind of downer of an episode, come back next time, because that will be, I think we're probably just going to spend that whole episode gushing.
Yes. And thank you so much for supporting us. And we will see you next time.
You have been listening to Click It Cast, a Beverly Cleary podcast featuring Phil Gonzalez and John McCoy. Click It Cast is part of the Incomparable Network. To find out more about the Incomparable Network and the other podcasts it offers, visit incomparable.com. Smart, funny podcasts.